And we next have John Connolly, and he is from McMaster's University in Canada. And John will be talking about innovations in assessing cognition in nonverbal children with autism. John.
Good morning. I'd like to thank Kim Farr as well for accepting this symposium and for Connie doing the legwork to get us all organized. I'll also point out I'm up here with water and a computer. So, we'll see. Also, I'd like to congratulate all of you who work with autistic children, because this is my first time doing this sort of work. In my career, I've worked with unmedicated schizophrenic patients, depressed patients. Now I'm working with brain-injured patients. I've never worked with a more difficult population to test. So this was a proof-of-principle study involving a very few children, and I have to admit at times I was grateful for the very few aspect of that. They were terrific to deal with in some respects, but it was a real challenge. So I'd also like to thank my colleagues here, Joanne Reitzel and Peter Zatmari, for helping us get the children into this testing, and Amy Harrison and some of the other names at the end for actually running and dealing with some of the children. So I'm something of an anomaly because this, as I said, is a proof of principle study, and I've never done autistic or research on autism before. And it was really Portia Iverson that contacted me because of the work I was doing with brain-injured populations who are nonverbal and non-communicative. And we started this work in the mid-90s. And so it's really that's the background that I'll flesh out now in the next few minutes. But in terms of the outline of this talk, I'll be just talking about methods of assessment using event-related brain potentials. And I say within neuropsychological tests. In other words, not correlated with them, but I'll explain that in a second. Then applications in what I'm more comfortable with, which is acquired brain injury, and then how we've applied them in autism. Now this is, and I wonder if the sound man over there, whose attention I'm desperately trying to get, well done, if you could just kill the sound on this, because it's just going to be a distraction, I think. But these are some famous cases of people who have sustained acquired brain injuries, so they've had traumatic brain injury or stroke, and have made the news, basically. So Terry Schiavo on the top left, and some other people. And this is someone we tested a number of years ago. I'm only showing this in terms of brain injury and lack of communication. I'm using up all my time here. Now, I have this up here only because these are the obligatory criteria for the diagnosis of a vegetative state. And you can read this as well as I can. And the key phrases here are what constitutes evidence and what constitutes a response. The way we view this, and I think the Royal College did as well, they were opening the door just a crack because they did this in 2003 and we and others had already published our research, some of it. They were saying it is whatever you choose it to be in some respects, because really the bottom line to what I'm saying is behavioral analysis is inadequate for many of these people. And also what is interesting, again, coming into the autism field as a novice, is how much nonverbal autistic people are treated much like vegetative patients. The assumption being if there is nothing coming back from them, if there is no communication back, the assumption is there is no intellectual horsepower to make that communication back. And I'll be showing you some evidence from vegetative patients where it is demonstrably untrue, and then from a little girl we tested with autism, where it again is, in our view, demonstrably untrue. Now, the justification for this new method is why we started this in the first place, is that, again, my background is clinical neurophysiology, and we rely on ERPs, or evoke potentials, heavily in helping with diagnosis and assessment. But the ERPs historically that we looked at were brainstem, middle latency, and various somatosensory, visual, auditory, evoked potentials, things that are regarded as hardwired, generally speaking, and very reliable. And that is that world, and it's very, very useful. Anytime you got into the areas of cognition, historically they would then say, okay, our work is done, it goes to a neuropsychologist now. And the reason for that is that cognitive ERPs, like April was just talking about and I will talk about, were viewed as too unstable, too unreliable. So I could test you one moment and you'd look one way, I'd test you 10 minutes later, you'd look a different way. And over the years, we've discovered how untrue that is, that it was much more to do not with the people we were testing and not with the paradigm, but the fact that we were not constraining the experimental situation rigorously enough. So if it's a very loose experimental situation, you could be sitting in there thinking, my God, this is boring. I wonder what's for lunch. Dinner last night was good. Oh, and I'm still pressing a button to the deviant stimulus that I'm hearing now and again. You can be doing all sorts of things. Within the context of a neuropsychological test, you cannot be. So it's very demanding. So what we did was we adapted neuropsychological tests, and you'll see there's a great emphasis here on language and communication, but we adapted neuropsychological tests so that they could be computer presented, and also we could record ERPs to the actual stimuli in the test. So, and the idea was that we could keep the psychometric properties of the neuropsychological test, which we were very obsessive about doing. So it's not that we would have a rough approximation of intellectual functioning. We could give someone a test score if that was our goal. And I wouldn't be here if we hadn't succeeded. So that's what we are doing. So, and that explains that bit. Then the benefits of ERPs, I'll just skip over. I'm going to assume that you know them. They're wonderful. You can talk to me afterward if you're not sure. I think a critical feature is that they are independent of overt behavior. That's absolutely essential for the patient I showed you in the video and for the children, for example, that we tested in this study. And also, they are a very good substitute for behavioral and verbal responses if, in fact, the person is unable to make those. The point is, if they're able to make those, it means by definition that it was preceded by a brain response. We can record that if they can't do the other things. And also, compared to some of the other measures we use, like fMRI or MRI generally, it's portable, it's cheaper, and provides you also with some very good millisecond by millisecond estimations of what someone is doing. So, to stroke. The Peabody Picture Vocabulary Test is one of the first tests that we adapted for this, what we call Neurovox procedure. And we, again, made sure that it fit the site. We kept the psychometric properties. But basically, the participant would see a picture and 750 milliseconds later hear a word that described the picture correctly or incorrectly. So at a low level of vocabulary, there are three in the Peabody. At the low level of vocabulary, the person would see a ball come up on the screen, and then about a second later, not quite, they would hear the word ball or hear the word car, and they would show particular sorts of responses. On the left-hand side is just a description of a small stroke sample, which I'll show you in a second, but this is a proof of principle study with 24 undergraduates, and basically, I'll see if I can get this cursor thing going. Okay. So if we just look at this column here, which is at a place on the head, PZ, so the back of the head, these are undergraduate students at a university I used to be at. And so you can see that when they see the picture of a ball and they hear the word car, they show what's called an N400. I should point out that April plots negative down. We plot negative up, as it's meant to be plotted. So just if you're confused that these waveforms look like they're going in different directions, they are, because we're plotting negative up. We like to emphasize the negative in life. But nonetheless, you can see that this is a semantic response. So it's recognizing that the verbal description of the picture doesn't fit. And the dark blue line here is that down here is simply the response to the stimulus, the word when it does fit. And you can see when we get to a next level of vocabulary, the lines are a little bit closer now because they're missing some of the words. And finally, when we get to very tough words, or at least for first-year students at an unnamed university that I'm no longer at, they struggled with them. So that would be words like homunculus versus pedagogue. Pedagogue became controversial because they mistook it for another word. And when I explained that that wasn't the word they were thinking of. So this shows you, though, a very nice separation in these waveforms, which is really what we are after. The other thing is I'm showing what are called grand averages. This would be like testing everybody in the room and averaging you all together. They're very nice and clean, but that's not what we're after. Not that we're after dirty data, but we're after individual subject data. That's absolutely key for us. So here's a group of stroke patients, and I'll be very quick on this. How am I doing? Oh, good. All right. I normally rival Fidel Castro in speech length, but nonetheless. So if you look at here, these are a group of left hemisphere stroke patients that were selected for having communication problems. We were able, however, to get the normal Peabody done with them, as well as our version of it. And we then did a simple split half into those who scored on the normal Peabody or the standard Peabody in the lower half and those who scored on the upper half. And we simply looked at how they did on the ERP responses, as I've just described them to you. And you can see that those who scored lower, 3 out of 5, and I hope you can see there are little asterisks between those two and then this person, 3 out of 5 on the low level, so that's ball and car and ball and ball, etc., they showed brain responses that indicated they were keeping up, they were following along. 2 did not, but 3 did. When we got to the middle level of vocabulary, slightly tougher words, none of them showed it. When we looked at those who scored better on the Peabody, standard Peabody, 5 out of 5 showed reliable brain responses. You can see they're not as clean as the nice undergraduate grand average, but nonetheless. And then 3 out of 5 showed brain responses that indicated they were following along. I will say that when we've developed an algorithm for this to do this with the ERP data. When we correlated it in this study with stroke patients with the standard Peabody scores, we got a correlation of 0.87 between our ERP data and the actual performance on the test, which is remarkably high. So again, this is not giving you an estimation of cognitive function. It's virtually giving you, as a neuropsychologist said to me, this is virtually giving us a Peabody score if we do the whole thing, which we do if possible. So, traumatic brain injury. This is just very quickly to show you the sorts of stimuli that we use. And these are, if we just concentrate on, this was a different experiment, but it's basically the SEN400, a semantic response. And we have sentences that ended with a perfectly okay terminal word. So in other words, the sentence made semantic sense. And then sentences where it ended in a completely wrong way, just semantically incorrect. Then we had a little game where, because we were looking at 2 different types of responses in the original work, the gambler had a streak of bad luggage. It starts out phonologically sounding okay, but it ends up going terribly wrong. And the point is, what we saw with the N400 was it was larger and it was delayed, because in a sense you've been garden-pathed. It's really the foundations of comedians. They leave you one way and then take you in a completely different direction. And so we were looking to see if we would get responses that would be sensitive to this. And if we just look at this response here, sorry, these are crummy slide, it's very old data. But you can see the big response here is the winter was harsh, this allowance, so just semantically wrong. The gambler had a streak of bad luggage, is this that response there? You can see it here in a different part of the head. And basically it was delayed, and the subtraction waveforms indicated it was also unusually large, larger in fact than the response to the completely wrong. The delay really produced a large and delayed response. This is a young man that we saw after a traumatic brain injury, stabbed in the head. This is the entry wound. The entry was left side of the head. And you can see that the injury was catastrophic. It left him in a vegetative state.
I call it global aphasia here because when we first tried to publish this work in the mid-90s, this was the first demonstration that you could do this sort of work with vegetative patients. Journals would not accept it because clearly he was not vegetative if he had cognitive function. We explained it was he was meeting all the criteria, but that didn't cut any ice. The only way they'd take it is if we called him globally aphasic, which of course he was, but it really underestimated what his problems were. So he was vegetative. We tested him in the paradigms that I've been describing to you of sentences that made sense and didn't make sense, and then ones that God empathed him. And basically, he showed very nice N400 activity here. When we tested him again, it was delayed a bit, but he even showed it stronger a few weeks later. This is a grand average for people like the slide I showed you before of a group of people, healthy controls, and this is one of the controls. So we demonstrated that he actually was not in that shape as he looked, and he received physiotherapy and extensive intervention. He is now back living a life as normal, even playing football again, soccer again. And the only thing he does not do anymore is speak. But other than that, he's absolutely fine. And before that, he was in a vegetative state. So we were quite enthused about the technique. I will tell you that the fellow I showed you in the video, when we tested him 3 years after his accident, these are his data. He also showed a very nice N400, which you can see in the green line there. Oh, dear. So, autism. So, the paradigms that we've used here are subject's own name. I'll skip over mismatch. Subject's own name, that's where you hear a lot of names being presented to you auditorily, and one of them is yours. And we know from brain injury, some patients respond to their own name but not to the others. Sentences, like I've just showed you, and then the Peabody Picture Vocabulary Test. So although this is the key element, I can go quickly here because I've hopefully primed you for all of this. Now, this is a control subject, an 11-year-old control, and the response you can see down here, again, positive is down, but this is responding to his own name, and the response tends to be largest toward the back of the head where these are being recorded. So he's doing just fine. When we played him the sentences, he showed very nice N400 activity to sentences that did not make sense. Perfect. And then when we did the Peabody with him, the simple vocabulary, once again, he showed very nice N400 responses. So great control. I'll skip over the next control who did exactly the same thing. The only thing we did differently with him was he was a bit older, so we went to the second level of vocabulary with him, and he showed that he clearly understood what words were meaning here. Here is a young girl we tested, nonverbal autistic child, 11 years old. And again, the same criteria that everyone is using here, fewer than five words. And when we tested her with subject's own name, so you can see she showed a lovely response to her own name, which she clearly knows. When we tested her with sentences, she showed a very nice N400 to sentences. I'll point out these were the same sentences we used with adults. We did not reduce the intellectual level of these sentences. I don't think they're very difficult, but nonetheless, they weren't for children. And so she showed very nice responses to this. And when we did the Peabody at the lowest level, so she saw the picture, heard words that did not match it, she showed a very nice N400, as you can see. This is another person. Okay. I've been told that hurts if I'm hit with it, so I'll be quick. This is also a nonverbal child, autistic, and he does not show these responses. You can see, you might say, well, isn't that an N400? Everything is high here. These are just unreliable waveforms. He moved around endlessly. We simply could not get good recordings from him, but I think these are as good as we could get, and he did not seem to be showing very much at all. One could argue that isn't this an N400? It could be. Personally, I don't think it is because it's distributed toward the front of the head, which is very, very atypical. And he really just did not seem to be cluing in to very much. We did get his subject's own name, which he also did not respond to terribly well. I don't have that slide with me somehow. But nonetheless, he just did not respond. So it's not as if the paradigm is getting these responses from everyone. So basically, the conclusion of this, of all this work is I think the combination of highly constrained tests and highly relevant stimuli like the person's own name with ERP recordings provides a clear value-added methodology for assessing non-communicative individuals. For whatever reason, they're non-communicative. Also for ABI and autism, I think purely behavioral assessment, it's really questionable at this point as to whether you're getting the best view of the person in front of you. And also, I'd like to just toss this out here, the introduction of some type of neuromonitoring or neuroimaging methodology as a standard assessment tool for difficult-to-assess patients could be considered overdue. And I would just like to thank the people that supported this research in one way or another, especially Autism Speaks. And finally, thanks to my colleagues who helped run this work. And that's it. Thank you very much.
I had a question. To get reliable measures on an individual level, do you have a feel for how many trials you're looking for? And then are there also some tests that, to keep it a standard, keep the standardization, there just aren't enough trials you'd be able to use that?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It depends on what component you're looking at as to how many trials you need. For example, especially as he's local, a fellow in town here named John Polich is really probably one of the world's experts on a response called the P300. And John has written that he thinks at least 30 trials to get a P300 in a typically developed person, no problems, is essential. And I wouldn't disagree with that. Brainstem, you need a few thousand, so it has that range. I think you've hit upon the real issue here of the tests we adapt. If we're going to keep to keeping the tests as they are, we don't add stimuli, we don't fiddle with the tests. So we're running sometimes a very thin edge of reliable waveforms. However, with rigorous and somewhat neurotic testing procedures, we really are succeeding. So we do sometimes get below. On the SUN paradigm, the subject's own name, that is not a standard neuropsych test. But on things like the Peabody, we're floating right around the area of what's acceptable. So if we lose too many trials to blinks or movement, you know, we might run the test again like a couple of days later, but we have to play that game. It's dealing with any kind of clinical group is always tricky, frankly.
For patient number three, just anecdotally, do you believe that there was an absence of the M400 and the P300, or was the data just too dirty to tell?
That's also a good question. Something that we're very at pains to say all the time is that the classic, what we all get told as an undergraduate, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So I think it our view of those data, because we also have analyzed these several other ways, including frequency analysis, our best guess at this point, because we also tried to test him on several occasions, I think these data are accurate. I don't think that he is showing any responses like the little girl did. Yeah, but that's also very germane. Yeah. Okay, thank you. I should hit enter.